we are going to do this morning are three things. Acknowledge what I have been about without knowing it, which was set you all up for Ismael Garcia. He is going to go through with you a history of the idea and application of politics. I hope he'll do Aristotle and Machiavelli for you just to give the parameters, but also Luther and Calvin and so on, the differences in ways of dealing with these things. And that is his specialty, so he will be able to do all of that for you, which I think now, just as I wanted to know more from him, that you will be especially keen on what he will have to say. And then I want to look at the problem in the 20th century with you, as we have been doing, and thirdly, suggest where we may look for solutions apart from the political, but rather in the ecclesiastical and spiritual areas, where I feel a little bit more at home than in the political. I told Ismael this morning that I had undergone a kind of conversion in preparing these lectures, because it's been a long one. I told you something about it last night. From being a history of ideas person and a pure theologian, if such exists, I came to recognize the intertwining of theology and life and politics and government and so on. It's a human endeavor as well as one that we hope is at least somewhat inspired. Theology is. And so it's intertwined in our world and has all kinds of repercussions sometimes we don't see. But what I have come to realize in working over these lectures is that I really have to get busy in that dirty world out there of politics and ethical problems in a way that I had never done before. And I wonder if that's unique to me or if some of the rest of us are beginning to be more aware of the intertwining of these difficulties and our obligations as Christians and as citizens of the United States to take more responsibility into our own hands. I was going to say something more about the two kingdoms because I was asked a question last night and I was just too tired to remember anything, and I woke up thinking now, trying to get that back together. But I think that probably Professor Garcia will do some of that with you too. But I would say just this, that the reason that Luther changed, I think, is that he really believed in his very early period in the 20s, early 20s, before the peasant revolution, that his doctrine of justification by faith alone, without the works of the law, would create much more of a conversion in people than actually happened. I think he really did expect that the justified would, out of gratitude to God, be good. And human nature being what it is, it didn't quite work out that way. And he had to readjust somewhat. So when he wrote to the German nobility that their duties as Christians and as part of the priesthood of all believers in that world, that justified world of true faith, that their particular duty was to restrain the evil, and that the truly justified would be good and would not need that much government. And I think Luther found as the years went by that that wasn't quite the way it worked out. But in any case, he stressed therefore that because the nobles had the duty to protect the people had the obligation to obey the nobles, and that sets up a dynamic which I know Professor Garcia will talk with you more about tonight, but it also confuses the kingdoms. Well, so much for backtracking. Today in our world, as you know probably, the United States is very likely one of the more religious, or maybe even the most religious of the developed nations. I was astounded when I was in Scotland to find that there was 11% of the Scottish population going to the kirk. A smaller percentage of, in England, and 5% in France, going to church. People who believe in God, 50 to 60%, but they didn't feel any obligation to act on that. So secularization is a very real thing in our world today. We have issues, therefore, in this religious nation, which we still are. One of them, I think, is the strength and role of the mainline churches. The other is the relation of the mainline churches to the fundamentalists who are growing in strength. And the relation of both of these to the fringe groups, which are no longer the sort of exotic Eastern-oriented cults, but I think we're more concerned now with the neo-Nazi Christian groups who have been violent in our society and are growing because of a growing situation of insecurity in our country, appealing especially and often now to the farmers who can't find any reason why they are going under when they are very capable, strong, independent people. And suddenly they can't make it anymore, and who are they going to blame? And some of these neo-Nazi groups provide a very ready answer to that. It's the Jewish bankers, it's a conspiracy, a communist conspiracy to destroy America, and so on. And some of the farmers are listening now to things they would never in this world have listened to before. And there are other reasons, in times of instability, that people want to find answers and to organize and to do something when they feel powerless. They have got to feel they have a way of acting. And that is something we've got to be aware of and concerned about. I suppose in Missouri, I'm a little more in the midst of it. I don't know. I think probably the ranchers here are feeling it too, but I don't know that you're losing 25 to 30% of your farmers a year in bankruptcy. So those are some of the issues that set a background to where we are today. And we need then to look at the complexities of our freedoms and responsibilities. And I wanted to do that in the light of the First Amendment. For the founding fathers of this country, religion was a force for good citizenship and morality, but they did not want, of course, any establishment. So that the government was never to be in a position to decide who was right and who was wrong about religion, but was to protect the rights of people to the free exercise of their religion, and by the extension in many people's minds, non-religion, unbelievers, rights not to believe, so long as that exercise doesn't impinge on the rights of others to exercise their beliefs. No one was to be persecuted, no establishment. And what an amazing declaration that was. At the same time in Europe, religion was enforced in Spain. It's only recently Protestants could get visas. Soon to be banished altogether in France, and was thoroughly and deeply established in England. But in the USA, the First Amendment is born. It's an amazing thing to me. And it's very simple. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's it. And in Time magazine, I saw a marvelous cartoon in an article dealing with this, of an altar and a clerical person standing beside it, a bolt coming down from heaven, and a voice that said, "Thou shalt not make the Lord thy God like unto a political football." Which is the First Amendment in very popular terms. what a simple line it is. It's only a very few words, less than 15. And it's abused in various ways, and we want to see in what ways that is. The first one that we've all been concerned about, and we talked a little bit about last night, was those who take Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion, and they put the period right there, and say that that means that Congress shall have nothing whatsoever to do with religion at any time in any way, and what's more, that religion has no place in anything that is done by the government, whether it's running schools or having a chaplain in the Congress and so on. You know the people who are against that. And they the abuse of it is to carry it so far, as we discussed last night, so we won't dwell on it, but just to remind you briefly, to removing references that are appropriate to religion in historical documents and chastising congressmen and women if they make any reference to religion as though it were not a reality in the world. That is head in the sand behavior, if ever I heard of it. A religion is a reality, whether they like it or not, and it needs to be recognized and dealt with, and not made treated as though it simply didn't exist, or as they wished, that there were no such thing. So that kind of secularism, I think, most of us are against. And that's not secular humanism, of course. That's just plain secularism. And that is an abuse of the First Amendment because it also reads, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, those people would say, fine, go exercise it, but not in Congress and not in the government and not in our schools. And when you get to that point, then you're in an area where we really need to discuss what our consensus is about it. That religion may not be established, but the free exercise thereof may also not be prohibited in any way. And the abuse of that section, of course, is using religion as a shelter for otherwise unacceptable behavior. The thing that comes to mind is there's a great deal of discussion about this, but Ron Hubbard's Dianetics is one that seems to have been using it in that manner, as far as we can tell. But it's very difficult to make judgments about these kinds of things. But you can think of some nudist colony on Main Street or something would be something of that kind. But what is our consensus? That the government protects the rights of assembly and of practice of religion without endorsing any. And that's the point. Without endorsing any. And that's what we need to be careful about. And protect that no religion begins to set itself up as an established religion which has rights over other religions. We take it for granted somewhat, and we have to be alert now to what our politicians are saying and not saying, and what religious leaders are saying, and in some instances, demanding. And being alert doesn't mean always just being negative about it, but really listening. We have to listen to things such as, religion and politics shouldn't be separated, said Ronald Reagan at his prayer breakfast. And opponents of organized prayer in public schools are intolerant of religion. To that, I would like to give you Charles Bergstrom's response. We're not intolerant of religion, we just don't want the president involved in our prayers. And I think that sums it up pretty well. And what kind of stance one takes about prayer in school is, I think, probably pretty clear, that there's no place for it if we're not going to abuse the rights of others whose religion is not the same as ours. But then you come to such things as we've been discussing. What about celebrations of religious holidays like Christmas in this country? And that is a matter, I think, that we all need to be very thoughtful about. The Supreme Court allowed a Christmas pageant in, I think, Long Island. But as someone wrote about it, what does that mean to the Jewish members of that community, for instance? And would it be fair then to set up a menorah at the other end of the park? How does one handle this? How does one look at these things? They said the judges that made this decision came from a Christian tradition. To them it seemed perfectly normal to have a Christmas creche in a public square. But that might look very strange to Jews, Muslims, others in the community who feel that they are somehow alienated from the mainstream simply by that fact. So we need to be very sensitive about it. Paul Laxalt, this is the letter that I told you about, wrote a letter and sent to 80,000 fundamentalist Christian ministers. Dear Christian leader, do support us because of Reagan's commitment to traditional values. What are they? Are traditional values also conservative values? If you say they're the values of home and children and family, well, everybody's for those values, but how do you translate those values? Does it really mean traditional values that the woman should return to the kitchen and stay there? In some conservative groups, it does mean that. We have to listen to catchwords and spin them out and understand what they're talking about when these loaded terms are used. One commentator called Laxalt's letter un-American proselytizing. And then we have, on the other hand, Mondale in his 84 campaign. And you have to listen very carefully to this. The framers of the Constitution decided that religion would be here and was between ourselves and our God, and the politicians would be over there, and we'd never get the two mixed up. In America, faith is personal and honest and uncorrupted by political interference. And he got a tremendous round of applause and decided at that moment that that was going to be one of the boards in his platform. He got more applause, I think, than he'd expected. Well, we all resonate to that, but let's look at it a minute. First of all, here we have Mondale, who is the son of a minister, but in this instance was giving a political speech, and he said religion would be here, where I am, right? And the politicians would be there. So he's already said, I'm not a politician. They're over there, those guys that twist things and try to use the public for their own welfare. And I mean, in other words, what he was saying is the politicians are somehow not quite what we all want to be. I'm over here with you. And it's between ourselves and our God. And that's the privatization we've been talking about. And again, it turns out that that Professor Garcia is going to be talking about this. We talked a little bit about it already, but if you want to read something, and probably many of you already have read the book, How Far Privatization Can Go in the Minds of Many Americans, Churched and Unchurched, then you should read Habits of the Heart by Robert Bella. How many have read that? Yeah, it's a bestseller kind of thing. And what it does is look at, from a sociological point of view, types of Americans as exemplified in particular individuals. One was a typical businessman in Silicon Valley with his California privacy fence around his backyard. And another was a psychiatrist. And another was a Massachusetts small town manager. The small town manager in a factory loved his little town, and he was very much of a community person. But the other two were, don't come into my backyard unless I invite you. Don't come into my life. Don't ask me what I believe. Don't ask me to do anything apart from my business, which is providing me with this lovely house and garage and swimming pool and all of the kinds of things that make the good life. And don't ask me what it's for or any of these kinds of things. It's none of your business. and the psychiatrist was also trying to preserve this notion of whatever one believes is purely their own affair, nobody else's. So the privatization is one of the biggest and strongest obstacles, I think, in many ways, to a realization of what religion is about. We talked a little bit about that. I find it so deeply entrenched in the students that you almost have to take a pickaxe to get at it and break it up. And you have to keep coming back to them and back to them and saying, now, what is happening? What is happening here? What this whole handing on of religion and its values, its documents, and so on, is not a private matter. What we mean is that whether I believe or not is between my conscience and God. But once I believe, I'm in a group of believers of some kind. And I receive, even if I don't meet with them, I've received what I believe from somebody. It didn't just develop spontaneously in me. That's a very, very difficult notion in the United States. And until we begin to dig it out, I think that we're going to err with regard to how to handle some of the problems that I mentioned at the beginning. Uncorrupted by political interference. Is our religion uncorrupted by political interference? Certainly compared to the 16th century and to compared to places where religion is still established, perhaps. But do we never get the two mixed up? I mean, how can we protect the freedom to practice one's own religion if we don't have laws? Now, that's a mixing of it, but it's not a mixing up of it. I mean, it's not wrong, but it certainly is a mixing of it, and you have to be careful then how you implement the laws and how you write the laws. Don't we have to protect minorities from coercion by majorities? That's what our laws are for. Where does concern for our cultural roots come in, like the Christmas pageants and so on? It's not simple to separate the two and say, here is the one and here is the other, and never the two shall meet. I think Mondale was wrong. But how deeply he appealed to people, and we all react to that spontaneously. Yeah, he's got, that's what it is. But we have to rethink that, I think. And what do people on the other side mean, like Governor Cuomo and Geraldine Ferraro, when they said, very rightly, we can't make a private position a basis of public policy? But you have to ask, what do you mean by private? That they are Catholics, is that private? That they should make their belonging to the Catholic Church a determination in the way that they influence policy, that's another matter. But I think we have to look at these kinds of things and see how separable they really are. I think it's right to ask those questions. I also think Cuomo and Ferraro are perfectly right to say, as public persona, they can't be dictated to by the church to which they belong as private individuals. It's something like what we were talking last night of the split in the bishops, as what they think might be best to do as Roman Catholic bishops. Personally, like ordaining women, I know some who really think that's the right thing to do, but not now and not publicly. Don't print that, they would say, and don't attach my name to it. So private and public is we have to listen. These words that mean things to us, what do they mean if you push them? Do we make, when we do these kinds of, when we use this kind of language and when we understand these things, is there some way in which we are trying to make God in our image? That we're trying to make religion a basis for what we want to do politically? Harvey Cox summed up this whole situation, I think, a little bit in words that with which I certainly can't agree, although it doesn't point to answers. Everyone seems to agree that one cannot ultimately separate religion from politics. The question is, how are they to be related in such a way that civility and respect for minorities are guaranteed and nurtured? So, what can we do about some of these things? And you know what the problems are when you come down where the rubber hits the road, as they say. Abortion, drugs, homosexuality. These are the problems that are pushing us to look at these kinds of things. And in his campaign, Reagan, one of Reagan's spokesmen, said that opposition to abortion should be required of prospective judges. And I think what's happened recently is an indication that certainly that was a test. The two new nominees both passed. How do we deal with this? And I can't remember because I heard it on the radio, but it was a high-up government spokesman and somebody in the Justice Department with regard to drug testing. It's good for the whole society, and therefore, even constitutionally guaranteed rights can be bypassed. Now, that is very interesting indeed, and very dangerous ground, it seems to me. It belongs in a context which I understand pretty well from medieval history, that the common good is the object that we have to be concerned about. Individual rights have come to be very important for us in the United States, and our Constitution is built to preserve them. Once you start saying that a common good outweighs individual rights, then the way is paved, as you can see, and I could tell by your that the way is paved to paternalism. The government knows what's right for you, and therefore we can enact laws which will see that what is right for you is done, and that way goes towards fascism, and it's Hitlerian, finally. A dictatorship is the end of that line, if we get onto it. On the other hand, when we're in a bind like this, with drugs as serious as they are, and the common good threatened as it is, you see, this is not a simple situation anymore. It's a very difficult and complex one, as is abortion. So how do we find any kind of resources for dealing with these kinds of problems? I think as churches, they need to be addressed in all kinds of symposia and interaction, letters, discussions with people in the parishes, with one another, to come to a consensus that will begin to have some influence. And here it's not that religion is going to be established or is going to dictate to government, but that it should have something to say as part of the citizen's voice to government. Not making demands that it must be thus and so, even though everybody else is going to be against it. But this is our position, and we want to be clear about it, and we are citizens. And then finally, the need for a faith, and coming back to where I began, which is deeper and stronger than the confusions that are around us. And as I said before, and worried some of you, deeper than dogma. And then we get into the problem of relativism, right? Some of you are wondering about that. The answers aren't simple, but if the faith is strong, then there is also faith that this human dilemma has a godly answer somewhere. Not perhaps one that will be clear, do thus and so, and it will all be straightened out. But that in the end, as the hymn or the what you read this morning just before we sang, that God is the ultimate guide to what is happening and will bring about out of this confusion a greater and better people. I'll hesitate to say state, but that our working through together kinds of things is good for us. That maybe we needed even something as challenging as we now face to test the faith that we have, and to resist the desire to come up with immediate and facile solutions. Religion does answer the hard questions of who we are, where we've come from, what we're about, and for whom we are. Those are great and cosmic answers. They do not, however, guarantee that in our relating to the God who is the author of our religion, that we will not individually and as institutions go through what has been called dark nights. Times when we don't see answers, and dark nights have been in the history of spirituality, and I think it can be said also for groups, the test of faith. Can you hang on even when the answers are not lying there at hand and ready? Is it God you cling to, or is it formulations? And sometimes in the midst of the dark night, and as it begins to move toward the dawn, the answers that do begin to formulate themselves may be different from those that we thought we knew as we went into it. It's a time of purification and of searching and of, if it is inspired by faith and real trust, of openness to what God may be doing in spite of our human presuppositions. So spirituality is also not unrelated, it seems to me, to politics. It should not be unrelated to any aspect of human life. And even this one that Mondale would like to put over there, and now I'm using politics in the way I defined it, the government of human life, and Professor Garcia will give you much more academic responses to that. But that's what I mean. There is no aspect of our human life which is not or cannot be permeated by a deep trust, which I think is the basis of Luther's vision of Christianity, something that Lutherans have held most profoundly, although in ways different perhaps from the history of spirituality before. But that trust is the base. And out of it, and through it, and with it, I think that we can begin to work together on these problems, which at present seem to be too deep for any of us to come up with answers that are convincing for us. And as I come to an end here, I really will be interested to know, and I hope Walter will let me know, if out of your discussion some kinds of further developments come, because this is far from any kind of concluding word. I hope it is an incipient word, a beginning word, that you will all carry on and discuss and perhaps find some hope in it, because its final word is God. And thank you all very much.